What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Ron Blomberg, baseball's first designated hitter and the author of the book Designated Hebrew. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I know that summer doesn't officially begin until June 21st, but in many parts of the country, it actually starts with Memorial Day weekend. And as kids get out of school and temperatures rise, it begins to feel a whole lot like the season of sun and water and freedom. Or at least that's how I remember summer from childhood, when the last day of public school signaled total release from responsibility. Ah, those blissful last days of school. I believe that in my memory they were sometimes more pleasurable than the summer vacations that followed. Sometimes it's the idea of freedom that matters most, not even the reality of it. For most working people, this summer period isn't vacation at all, but there is a certain sense around an American synagogue, particularly among religious school families, that they are taking the summer off from Judaism and will see you again when school starts in the fall. I don't know at what point people began to feel that Judaism was a 9 or 10 month a year experience, but somehow that message has been communicated pretty universally in our congregational life. In nearly every Reform and Conservative congregation's life, to be honest, and there are definitely some families with whom I celebrated at the Siyum concluding ceremonies of religious school that I will not see again until late August or even September. I don't know what to do about this exactly, and neither does anybody else in the shul business, so far as I know. It's not that we don't preach the message that Judaism is a year-round commitment, a way to experience holiness in life every day, and I don't think it's even a conscious decision that people make to avoid religion when the weather warms up. It's just that somewhere along the way, we American Jews learned or decided that religion, or at least Judaism, is a pediatric exercise. Something to give to kids to make sure they get the right values and holidays and rituals, and hopefully marry the right flavor of person, and that we ourselves, the parents and even the grandparents, are exempt from actually experiencing the same things we require our kids to do. That's why the best supplemental religious schools in the world, and many of ours are very good, can only do so much. Kids learn and know prayers and holidays. They can chant from the Torah, sing about Israel and the festivals. They can celebrate their wonderful Jewish identity. But when the parents choose to just drop kids off and split for a free morning, and then don't model any particularly Jewish behaviors or provide Jewish experiences regularly at home, it sends a very, very strong message. Religion is just kid stuff. Grown-ups have more important things to do. You know, work out, go shopping, have dinner dates with friends, volunteer for other charities, and the like. It's not what we rabbis preach, of course, but it certainly is a message that comes out loud and clear, especially in summertime. Summertime equals no religious school, which equals no Judaism to speak of. And that's a shame. Because in truth, during the more relaxed pace of summer, we can experience some of the very best parts of Jewish life more fully, like the home celebration of Shabbat dinner, the opportunity to study Torah creatively in a less pressured environment. When kids don't have to rush from choir rehearsal to ballet to baseball practice to debate to student government to dance to karate to homework, they can actually experience life at a more human pace. And if we take the trouble to have them shut down their iPhones and other video devices for a little while and have real family time, that gives them time to explore and enhance their relationship with our magnificent Jewish tradition. At our own congregation, Temple Emmanuel, here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, we celebrate Shabbat in the summer with Chardonnay Shabbat services, wine, cheese, and fruit at 5 o'clock, a one-hour Kabbalat Shabbat service at 5:45, and then go have a Shabbat dinner with your family afterwards. It's a great way in the heat of summer to chill and enjoy being Jewish. And you don't have to get up early Sunday morning for religious school either. Shabbat is an ideal opportunity to enjoy being with family and friends, talk, eat, sing, share life in a way that goes well beyond Facebook posts. There's no way to tweet Shabbat. Spending device-free family and friend time is a unique way to add meaning, beauty, and holiness to your life. To play us in on this theme of Shabbat, especially summertime Shabbat and Shabbat peace, here's a cut from the new and quite wonderful CD called Armon Bizman by Sam Golden and Bob Hanshaw. It's the prayer Shalom Rav, grant great peace.
Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam. 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 Ki ata Tasim Leolam, Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam, Vetorinecha Levarech Et Amcha Yisrael, Bechol Et Uvechol Sha'a Tasim Leolam, Shalom Rav Yisrael, Amcha Tasim Leolam, Tasim Leolam, Tasim Leolam.
That was Shalom Rav from Armon Bizman, the new Friday night service created by Sam Golden and Bob Hanshaw. This is Memorial Day weekend now, once a solemn and serious time commemorating our war dead, now a good excuse to begin summer and head off for vacation. It's true that the actual observance of Memorial Day has declined to the point that it seems to represent not much more than a great weekend to start holding barbecues and pool parties, shopping for bargains at department stores and big box retailers, or heading off to the cool weather of San Diego or somewhere. But it's actually a bit of a shame, for remembering our honored dead is a kind of moral responsibility, and it has great resonance in Jewish tradition. The American Memorial Day began in the year 1866 in New York State, just a year after the end of the Civil War. Communities started to observe a decoration day to honor the dead of that great conflict. Within a couple of years, the observance had become national and near universal, a sign of the broad sense of loss that the terrible American Civil War had created. While the concept of a specific Memorial Day may go back to the 1860s, the idea of having a special time to remember and honor the dead is a particularly normal one for Judaism and has been so for many, many hundreds of years. Four times a year, in fact, we Jews observe a special service called Yizkor, remembrance that allows all of us who have lost loved ones to gather and remember their lives and meaning. This happens four times a year, with our Yisker services on Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot. In addition, there are two specifically Jewish versions of Memorial Day that are more contemporary commemorations, Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, and Yom HaZikaron, Israeli Memorial Day, both in the late spring. You could say that we Jews have a certain affinity for the somber observances of a Memorial Day, perhaps because we have so often lost people early under tragic circumstances. So we do well over this weekend to take a few moments to remember those who, in Abraham Lincoln's timeless words, gave their lives that that nation, our nation, might live. When we come back on Too Jewish on this Memorial Day weekend morning, we'll meet our guest, the delightful former ballplayer for the New York Yankees, Ron Bloomberg, baseball's very first designated hitter and a proud Jew. Find out what it was like to be an odd sort of baseball pioneer and a Jew in baseball in the 60s and 70s when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. It's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a bid price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish our guest this morning, Ron Bloomberg. He was the very first designated hitter. In fact, his biography is called Designated Hebrew, Jewish guy who was from Atlanta. He is also the only man, I believe to this day, ever chosen for the Parade All-America teams in high school in football, basketball, and baseball. He turned down 125 basketball scholarship offers, including one from John Wooden, the greatest coach ever at my alma mater, UCLA, and instead signed with the Yankees, picked in the first round, and came up. And then tell us the story about how you became the first guy to ever do this really weird thing, be a designated hitter.
Well, Rabbi, to be honest with you, the designated hitter in 1973, April the 6th, I screwed up the game of baseball. And, and the funny part about it was, I was down in spring training in Fort Lauderdale about 5 days before we were supposed to break camp. And unfortunately, I pulled a hamstring muscle. And back then, you know, you had 1 year contract. So, you know, if you go on the disabled list, you have no idea that your job's in jeopardy. You'd just be actually like Wally Pipp. You know, my position been taken by somebody else. So, flying up to Boston, Ralph Houck, Elston Howard, and Dick Houser came on the flight, and they sat next to me, and they said, you know, instead of putting you on the disabled list, we're going to let you hit. We're going to let you be the DH. You know, back then, the DH was a novelty. It was basically what I told many, many people. It was a glorified pinch hit, basically a glorified pinch hitter. And I never thought it was going to be in baseball for long enough, well, longer than 30 days. But look at it now. It's 40 years later. It's great. I love the DH in the game of baseball, and it's been fun to be able to use it. That's why I wrote my book, The Designated Hebrew, because I took it from the designated hitter. So it's been really fun for me, and I've had a lot of great things. And My family's had a lot of great things with it, and even to this day, after been out of baseball almost 30-something years, you know, I have a claim to fame, and like I said before, I screwed up the game, and I'm very proud of it.
And your bat is in the Hall of Fame. I think they called it designated pinch hitter for a little while. They didn't even settle on DH at first, didn't they?
Yeah, I was a designated pinch hitter, you know, because nobody had any idea. You know, they most of the guys thought it was a joke. The reason why they had it, the American League needed some, they wanted to raise attendance, and also they wanted to raise the run production in the game of baseball, and they tried something, and 40 years later, it has worked. And people don't realize that next year, there was a designated runner with Herb Washington with Oakland.
Oh, yeah.
And that lasted 1 year. And the designated hitter lasted 40 years. So it's been fun. It's been great.
We will talk much more with our guest, the very first designated hitter, Ron Bloomberg, when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio, TOOJewishRadio at yahoo.com, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We are now pleased and serene to welcome back a recurring feature of Too Jewish, Haikus for Jews from Zen Judaism. Wet moss on the old stones lying in the grass. I ponder whom to sue. And the Shiva visit. So sorry about your loss. Now, back to my problems. Those were haikus for Jews to koans on Zen Judaism. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center, Boker Tov. Guy, good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Yom Huledet Sameach to your wife.
Yom Huledet Sameach to my wife in Baal. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday in Baal. We've been talking about kids because of your status as a new father not too long ago and the school system in Israel, and we've come sort of to the point where kids graduate and go to college. First of all, it's a little different experience, of course. What percentage of Israeli kids go to college, and how does it work in terms of their relationship? Because everybody in Israel has some kind of army service, almost everybody. Let's talk about that.
Right. So the first major difference would be that when kids graduate from high school, the vast majority will not go straight away to college, but rather to a military service. And boys would serve for 3 years. If they're officers, it could be 4 years or even more,
longer, right?
And girls would serve for 2 years, and if they're going to combat units, for 3 years, and again, if they're officers, it could be more. So they will finish the army at around the age of 21, 22. At that point, usually most Israelis will take some time off, do some kind of work to gain a little bit of money.
Or travel.
And travel around, and then use that money to travel around the world, usually to the Far East or to South America.
Right.
Very long trips. 6 months would be very, very common for Israelis.
Normal length, right?
Very normal length of a trip. After that trip, they would come back to Israel around the age of 22, 23, and only then they will go into the university or college. And that's a significant difference because that means that they arrive in the university more mature after gaining experience in some cases, you know, very, very significant experience. If someone was a platoon commander in the army and had to lead 100 soldiers, you know, in combat areas or stuff like that, that person comes to the university by far more mature, with a whole different perspective of life. And also after doing this long trip in the world and seeing other cultures, getting it all in, and coming to the university more mature with more things that you can bring into the academic discussion. About 70% of Israelis go to universities and colleges and get an academic degree, at least a first degree, which is a 3 or 4 year
That's a degree. Tremendous percentage. 70% get a first degree.
About 70% of the population, which is, it is very significant. In Israel today, to find a job, any job, without an academic degree would be very challenging. Very challenging.
So really, education is at the forefront. Maybe next week we'll talk about the different kinds of universities in Israel and how the system works, because it's a little different from how we do things in the United States.
A little is an understatement.
Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking the last few weeks about the challenge of dealing with the question of why the European Jewish community, and really the world Jewish community, wasn't more effective at trying to turn aside the Nazi threat through international pressure, through other means, in the period leading up to the Holocaust. Not to blame the victims, but to try to understand what went wrong. Talked about the Comité, which was a group formed out of the Paris Peace Treaty, Versailles, it's probably the best known of those, and how that group worked kind of with other entities to try to prevent problems. But obviously, it wasn't too effective at dealing with Germany.
Right. Well, when you talk about the world Jewish community in the interwar period, you're really talking about the European communities plus the American Jewish community, because there was effectively, there was no State of Israel. The Jewish communities in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Argentina were powerless on the world stage. They were too small, whatever. So really, I mean, world Jewish community is the U.S. plus the European communities and sure. The huge communities in Europe that could actually have a voice, because there were still lots of Jews in the Soviet Union, but they were effectively prisoners. Soviets couldn't travel to conferences. I mean, if there was a token Jew from the Soviet Union, he or she was a government spokesperson. Yeah. So we're really talking about the communities of Germany, France, England, etc. And part of the tragedy of this chapter of history is that this comité, which was sort of effective to a limited degree in defending the rights of Jews under these various peace treaties in the newly created countries of Europe, was disavowed by major organizations like the British Board of Deputies, for example, or the French Alliance Israélite Universelle, because they were branded as too Zionist or too internationalist and not reflective of what in some cases were very particularistic, nationalistic concerns of British Jewry or French Jewry, each of which had very different reactions to the looming and growing threat of what first appeared like, could the Nazis take over? And then starting in 1933, the Nazis did take over, but would they dare implement the program that Hitler so clearly had announced?
Yeah, there was nothing vague about it. It was very obvious.
So in spite of the increasing obviousness and Kristallnacht and lots of other things, each of these entities was unwilling to give up its own institutional interests and its own agenda to act in a coordinated way until it was much too late. So there was the sad specter of, you know, yeah, the Comité might have been vaguely pro-Zionist and probably didn't include any active anti-Zionists, although it did include some non-Zionists. But is that a reason to disown it and disable it? The one thing that might have been an effective spokesperson or spokes entity, whatever. I'm right. not even sure what word to use there. But sure. basically, European Jewry, by its fractiousness and lack of unity and competing organizational interests, crippled itself. It emasculated itself and deprived itself of any effective voice. Now, if it had had an effective voice in the 20s or the early 30s, would it have made a difference? Hard question to answer, but it might have. And the fact is that it didn't, and it basically proved, tragically, to be completely ineffective. Ultimately, even in the newly created countries that had been created at the treaty, at the Paris Peace Conferences, because, I mean, we all know what happened in those countries, with a few exceptions like Bulgaria, Sweden, Denmark. I mean, there were, thank God, a few exceptions. But by and large, the Jewish communities were mostly eliminated. And what's left in all those countries is just a tiny, sad shadow of what once was.
Great and unfortunate lesson that somehow we as Jews need to kind of keep learning. In times of emergency, we must stand together. But probably it would be a good idea to do that before it's an emergency, too. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Two friends, Nicholas and Abe, find themselves delivered together to hell. One is Christian, the other Jewish. A little confused, they are startled to see a door in the wall open suddenly, and behind the door is perhaps the ugliest woman they have ever seen. She is 3 feet tall, dirty, and covered in thick black hair. Flies circle her, and you can smell her even over the brimstone. The voice of the devil is heard. Nicholas, you have sinned. You are condemned to spend the rest of eternity in bed with this woman. Nicholas whimpers as he's whisked through a door by a group of demons to his torment. This understandably shakes up Abe. He jumps up when the second door opens. As it inches open, he strains to see the figure of Jessica Upton. Delighted, Abe jumps up, takes in the sight of this gorgeous woman barely dressed in a skimpy bikini. Then he hears the voice of the devil saying, Jessica, you have sinned. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. This week we chant the dramatic portion of Shlach Lecha in the book of Numbers, the story of the Meraglim, the spies. The Israelites have journeyed to the borders of the Holy Land just a year and a half after leaving Egyptian exile. Under God's direction, Moses sends 12 spies, one from each tribe, princes of the people, wealthy men of standing, into the land of Canaan to scout the land, to see if it can be captured. The spies take a month and see the whole land and report back to Moses the land is very good, flowing with milk and honey. They bring back a huge cluster of grapes, so large it must be carried by 2 men on a pole, now the enduring symbol of Israel's tourism ministry. Everything's going to be great, only it's not. 10 of the 12 spies report that the people of the land are huge. We felt like grasshoppers next to them, they say, and numerous. The cities are fortified and unassailable. The Israelites have no chance in spite of God's support. 2 spies, Caleb and Joshua, deliver a minority report, saying that with God's help, the land can be taken, but the people are terrified. Again, they ask Moses and Aaron, why did you take us from slavery to kill us here at the hands of our enemies? It's at this point that the decision is made by God. This generation of former slaves will never be able to become a free people in its own land. The psychological shackles of slavery are too strong to overthrow in one generation. And so, after a failed, leaderless attempt to invade the land without God's approval or Moses' leadership, the people are condemned to wander in the wilderness for 38 more years, a total of 40 since they left Egyptian slavery, until a new young generation can emerge to take the reins and enter the land with the mentality of freedom. It's a great lesson in the process that is required to cleanse the trauma of failure from the minds of a community. Often, it's not one single act or great revolution that truly remakes a people or country. It's the generational turn that comes from learning that things can be done differently, that freedom is truly a birthright. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, the delightful former New York Yankee ballplayer Ron Bloomberg, will explain what it was like to be the very first designated hitter, designated Hebrew, ever, when we come back on To Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million-dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
There is serious trouble again with the Holocaust Claims Conference, the independent Jewish organization that allocates German government money to survivors of the Holocaust. This time, it is fraud that has been uncovered, and now there's an apparent cover-up of that fraud that's being exposed. This is not a pretty story. 2 weeks ago, Semen Dumnitzer, a Claims Conference employee in Germany, was convicted in New York on federal fraud charges for being the ringleader of a scheme that siphoned off $57 million in German government funds meant for needy survivors. This week, it has been revealed that, contrary to his earlier claims, Julius Berman, who is chairman of the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany and a prominent leader of American Jewry as well, was warned about the massive Holocaust compensation scam more than 8 years before the fraud became public. Berman then directed his own inquiry into the fraud allegations but failed to act on the fraud that was taking place. He also kept news about the allegations and his own actions from his fellow board members at the Claims Conference where the fraud was taking place. Berman, the Claims Conference's top lay leader, personally directed an early investigation into the fraud of the organization, which processes restitution claims for Holocaust survivors. The documents revealed this week contradict a statement by Claims Conference spokeswoman Hillary Kessler-Godin, which laid responsibility for the group's failure to stop the fraud early exclusively on the shoulders of Karl Brozik, its former director in Germany, who conveniently died in 2004. It was Brozik who led the investigation into detailed allegations about the scheme that the group received in an anonymous letter in June of 2001, or so the spokesperson said. The Claims Conference failed to pursue the early tip-off, even though a staffer's preliminary investigation of the charges supported the allegations. The documents that were released established that Gideon Taylor, then the Claims Conference's executive vice president, worked together with Berman on a separate follow-up investigation. But no action was taken until 2009, 8 full years after the tip was received, when two obviously spurious claims led to the FBI being brought in on the case. The $57 million scheme went on for almost 15 years. 31 individuals, including Domnitzer and about a dozen other now former claims conference employees, have pleaded guilty or been convicted in connection with the fraud. Clearly, it's time for Jules Berman to resign as head of the claims conference. This failure to act in a timely manner to prevent years of theft is unconscionable. Can there be a worse form of fraud than stealing money from needy Holocaust survivors? In other news, the successor to Hugo Chavez as the newly elected president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, last week rejected charges of anti-Semitism by revealing his own Jewish roots. My grandparents were Jewish from a Moorish background who converted to Catholicism in Venezuela. The mother of my Minister of Communication and Information, Ernesto Villegas, also comes from that tradition, Maduro said. But even if the Venezuelan president is a member of the tribe, some observers are questioning his intentions. Why is Maduro so interested in making a claim about his Jewish ancestry? If it's true, he'll have to prove it, said Caracas-born Yolanda Podosinski, whose family helped establish the Jewish community in Venezuela after emigrating from Poland and Austria. I'm suspicious of his motives, she said. He was handpicked by a predecessor who hated Jews and surrounded himself with leaders of other countries who are anti-Semites. Maduro is following in the footsteps of Chavez, said Podosinski, who emigrated to New York 20 years ago. We know the name Maduro has Jewish origins, but I think his grandparents were baptized. After the head of the Latin American Jewish Congress accused Venezuela of driving the rise of anti-Semitism in the region, Maduro hit back by revealing his Jewish roots and added, "We are a humanist people. We are not anti-Semitic. There has never been anti-Semitism in Venezuela. Here we welcome all religions. We are an open-hearted people," Maduro said. He did not then add, "Some of my best friends are Jews." Maduro's predecessor, the charismatic neo-socialist Hugo Chavez, routinely used anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic rhetoric against opponents, particularly opposition leader Enrique Capriles Radonski, whose grandparents were Polish Holocaust survivors. Maduro defeated Capriles Radonski in a close race to succeed Chavez. I love LA. In politics closer to home, Los Angeles has elected its first Jewish mayor in history. Eric Garcetti, whose mother is Jewish and his father is of mixed Italian and Mexican descent, defeated Wendy Gruel, who is not Jewish but whose husband is, by about 6 percentage points, to become the Democratic mayor of the second largest city in America. There are about 600,000 Jews in the L.A. area, and the Jewish vote represents 20% of the active electorate in Los Angeles. Mazel tov to Eric Garcetti, first Jewish mayor of L.A.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York.
And in other mayoral news, he's back. Ex-New York Representative Anthony Weiner, who was forced out of office in a remarkable scandal, announced his run for mayor of New York City. "Look, I've made some big mistakes. I know I've let a lot of people down," the Democrat said in a two-minute video on the internet. "I've also learned some tough lessons. I'm running for mayor because I've been fighting for the middle class and those struggling to make it for my whole life, and I hope I get a second chance to work for you." The veteran Democratic lawmaker resigned from Congress in June of 2011 after lying about tweeting an illicit photo of himself, you know, kind of nude, to a 21-year-old female supporter. Weiner's wife, Huma Abedin, appears in the video supporting him, as does their young son Jordan, who was born a few months after the scandal broke. Weiner, who is 48 years old, ran for mayor in 2005 but lost in the Democratic primary. He now faces a crowded field, but still has millions in his political war chest from before his resignation, when he was considered a frontrunner to replace Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who has now completed his allowed three terms. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back our guest this morning, Ron Bloomberg. He is best known as the very first designated hitter ever with the Yankees. Boy, it's now 40 years. I must be getting old. Ron, you were actually quite a hitter. You were a good hitter until you tore up your knee. Do you have any regrets about baseball?
Well, no, not at all. I did something what I wanted to do. Being from the South, the big thing, I was growing up with a lot of people that were very anti-Semitic. And, you know, I grew up with basically that back then in Atlanta, back in the 60s, most of my friends were in the KKKs, and most of my teammates were in the KKKs. And I saw a lot of problems, and fortunately, they never bothered me and my family because I was a good athlete. So I was very, very lucky on that behalf. And I had no regrets. Unfortunately, I had quite a few injuries throughout my career, and it was not fun. You know, when they counted me to be the next Mickey Mantle, nobody could have been another Mickey Mantle. But, you know, being a Jewish ball player from the South, coming up to New York, and I was the first Jewish ball player that actually played for the Yankees. And you know, and they wanted something. And, you know, when I did play, I did extremely well. But unfortunately, I did have a lot of injuries. I had two shoulder operations and a knee operation. And unfortunately, back then, we just did not have the modern technology of all these great assets that they actually have for the to rehab your injuries. We, you know, everything was it was like voodoo back then, and so it was a lot different. And but no, I have no regrets at all. You know, New York was the greatest city in the whole world, the greatest. You know, the Jewish population took great care of me, and the good part about it was, you know, I was their person that they always idolized. And, you know, to have something like that and to have the young kids, even to this day, for me to be able to talk to the young kids, even though they don't know too much about me. You know, their parents would tell them to look at the Jewish encyclopedia, or there's been a lot of Jewish books about Jewish athletes. So I have no regrets whatsoever. I had the greatest life in the world. I got the greatest family in the world, and I had a greatest career in the world. So, you know, I was very, very blessed, and I was very, very lucky to do the thing I wanted to do in life.
You once said that you were invited to every single bar mitzvah in New York when you were playing for the Yankees. It was like you were related to everybody. Must have been quite a thrill.
Absolutely. I was, even to this day, I do so much up in New York. I work with a lot with the Steinbrenners and with Steiner Sports up in New York. And you know, even to this day, this people will recognize me in twofold. They would think of me as a first DH, number one, or they would think I was related to Mayor Bloomberg. So I really don't have. So I cannot lose, to be honest with you.
You're in good shape, but, either way.
Even to this day, Rabbi, I go up to New York probably around just doing speaking engagements for the Jewish synagogues. And you know, I probably do maybe 40 to 50 a year or just on that. But, you know, I'm very, very much involved with the New Jersey Y Camp, and it's the largest Jewish sleepaway camp in the country, and we got 4,000 kids. And I'm very, very much involved in that. And you know, the point about it is, you know, yes, once I do go back to New York, a lot of them will still ask me, will I light the candles for the bar mitzvahs and the wedding? So I'm very, very much involved with all those people up there.
All right, a very important question. What kind of sandwich did the Stage Deli name after you?
Let me tell you something. Unfortunately, the Stage Deli is out of business now after 75 years.
It's tragic.
It's the worst, but it's corned beef, pastrami, and chopped liver. But I don't like chopped liver. But the corned beef, pastrami, and the Russian dressing, that was really me.
That sounds delicious.
I have
delicious.
No idea how they put the chopped liver on it, because I didn't like chopped liver that much. But it's great to be You know what, Rabbi? It's great to be able to go into a place, and after you've been out of baseball for so many years, people will say, you know, nice things about you, and you know, and you know, that's what I always wanted to do, and that's what always my parents always brought me up. You know, I mean, what goes around comes around, and you know, and if you're nice to people, they're always going to be nice to you, and people all across the country has been extremely nice to me. And
Ron, you said you were out of baseball, but the truth is, in 2007, and I know you still do some scouting and some other work too, but you had the remarkable opportunity to manage the Beit Shemesh Blue Sox in the inaugural season. I think it turned out to be the only season in the Israel Baseball League. Tell us about that experience.
Oh, Rabbi, that was wonderful. You know, I had an opportunity. And in 1973, Golden Meir and Moshe Dayan asked me to go to Israel. But I never went because of the problems that they had.
Yom Kippur,
you know,
War, sure.
And, you know, and so I never went, but they wanted me to go and to talk to the people over there, but I never went over there, and I always really, you know, wanted to go. So I had an opportunity in 2007 when they opened up the new, they was trying to have baseball open in Israel. So it was myself, Art Shansky, and Kenny Hosman. Of course, you heard of those guys. And,
of course.
And, you know, I had an opportunity to go over there. It was wonderful. It was, you know, we played on prehistoric fields, and everything was totally different from what it was in the States. But, you know, it was great. How in the world can you not love it when you're in Israel, you know, you're playing baseball, which you love, and being Jewish? And so that's the ultimate of the world, and but unfortunately it did not work out, and financially it was not run correctly. The people in Israel were wonderful people. They really took care of us. The government took real good care of us, and it was great. I mean, it was wonderful. We lived in Tel Aviv for 2.5 months, but the only thing I hated about Israel was the food. I couldn't eat the food. I didn't like that.
And, well, you really can't get a decent hot dog in Israel. I can vouch for that.
No, it was, I wanted my, the only place we ate, most of the Americans, we ate at a place in Tel Aviv called Mike's. And so we ate there. That was the closest to American food that we had. So, you know, the food, you know, the best part about the food in Israel was the bread and the fruits.
Yep.
But outside of that, I couldn't eat it. I lost 25 pounds, and I think everybody on my team probably lost between 15 to 20 pounds. So, you know, that was the only drawback of the league.
Well, it could be the Israeli diet. You told a story, I think, about having a couple of Orthodox guys on your team in Beit Shemesh, and they took time out to say mincha, you know, to daven behind the food stands. So that's quite a story, but I understand your team lost.
We did lose that game. We didn't lose too many games.
No, not too many.
That was the most, I think that was probably one of the most incredible things I've ever seen, because I have never seen it. You know, when you grow up, when you, you know, grew up in the South, you know, the South is a lot different than, you know, mostly, well, not anymore, but when I was growing up down South, you know, being Jewish was very, very proud, but nothing was being Orthodox, and, you know, nothing was kosher. We had no idea what it was.
Right.
So we go to Israel, and I was managing. I think it was probably about the fourth or fifth. Now, well, probably about the third or fourth, fifth game. I remember that we had to have two Israelis on every team. So we're playing the game, and I was coaching at third base because being the manager and watching my team. And I remember the two of the Israelis came up to me, they came up to me and they said, you know, we got to go. And it was, probably about in Israel, it was probably about maybe 6 o'clock in the evening. And they had to have the service. And they said, you know, we'll be gone for maybe 15, 20 minutes. So I'm at third base. They, you know, put all their, you know, things on, and, you know, they took their the book, and, you know, they go right behind the concession stand. And the good part about it, the concession stand was kosher. So So, you know, they had probably, that game, we probably had maybe 3,000-4,000 people. So we really had a lot of people at our games because we're at a place called Kibbutz Gezer. That was going towards...
I know exactly where it is. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, sort of. And
that's correct. That's where our game was.
I saw that field, by the way. I can tell you that field is not exactly Major League quality field. We actually played a little bit.
Not at all. In the field, in right field, they had the lights right in the middle of right field.
Right.
And in order to catch a ball, you had to go like down a hill.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was incredible. I mean, it was, if you could play in those fields, you could play anywhere,
right,
like I told the guys. But, you know, they had, you know, way out on the field, and they had this service out there, and they probably had maybe 15 to 20 people, and they said in the loudspeaker, we're having the service, and anybody would like to attend, you know, come on over there. I'm at third base, and I'm watching my two of my guys, and, you know, when probably maybe 30, 40 people right behind the concession stand, they're diving and stuff. And I said, golly, Pete, I've never seen anything like that before, because, you know, I've never seen that before. So, you know, they came back, and they played in the game, because you had to play, you know, in the last inning, a couple of the guys. And, you know, we put them in, and we lost the game. And, you know, my pep talk is, and I said to him, I said, listen to me now. Unfortunately, you did not pray hard enough because we lost the game. And, you know, but it was fun. And it was, you know, I think the Israeli papers, I think the Jerusalem Post and the other English paper that they had over there, I think they took off and ran with that thing. So it was really, really nice, Rabbi. And, you know, and I've had, you know, such a great experience, and I have nothing to, you know, say anything bad about my life, because, you know, having my family, and I got the greatest wife in the whole world, and I got two kids that are physicians, and so it's great. So I'm very, very blessed in my life.
What a great outlook. I do have to know, by the way, there's beautiful fields of sunflowers right near that ball field in Kibbutz Gezer.
Oh, it's a sunflower. It's a sunflower capital. They told
Israel,
me
that's right.
It was
yeah.
incredible.
Yeah.
And these sunflowers are as big as someone's head.
That's right.
So,
gorgeous.
It was incredible. And like you said before, it's not a major league ballpark. I don't even think, you know, I think if you play stickball in New York City in concrete, I think you played on better fields than we did, because the lights on that field, we're lucky. We're lucky we had three light bulbs to play on that field. But it was fun. We did something that nobody's ever done before, and it was a great honor and great pleasure, and it was a great moment in my life.
Well, Ron, the other thing I wanted to mention is, in your first at-bat, the first designated hitter at-bat, you were hitting against Louis Tiant, a you know, famous pitcher for the Red Sox. And even though your bat's in the Hall of Fame, didn't you walk in that at-bat?
I did walk in the bat. You know, I told Orlando Cepeda, and I tell everybody, unfortunately, I got into the Hall of Fame the back door rather than the front door. But nobody can ever take it away from me.
That's right.
It's a Jewish ball player that has that great honor, and it's great to be part of it. It's great to be able to go up to Cooperstown and take my kids from my camp up there. It's right close to the Poconos, and when you go up to Cooperstown, New York, it's an unbelievable. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place, and to see these kids that, you know, read about me, and they see the bat up there, and they see my picture up there. So, you know, I feel like a star again. So it makes me feel good. It makes them feel good. And I'm glad it's up there, and I'm, you know, it's going to be up there for many, many years.
A Jewish star, I might add. I want to thank Ron Bloomberg for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Thanks so much, Ron. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be new author Helene Wecker, who has written a startlingly interesting and very good book called The Golem and the Genie. Our playout this morning comes from Armon Bizman, the new Friday night service from Sam Golden and Bob Hanshaw. It's their setting of a passage from the Song of Songs, Dodi Li. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, a good Memorial Day weekend, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Dodi Li, va'ani, lo haro'eh v'shoshanim. Dodi Li, va'ani, lo haro'eh v'shoshanim. Mizot olam min ha. Baptini achoti chala, uri tzafon uvoi tema.